Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. The NAMM Foundation is working to assure that all children have the opportunity to learn and grow with music, and that music is part of daily living for everyone. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hello, everyone. This is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation, coming to you from Summer NAMM here live in Nashville, Tennessee. Our great partnership with InterTalk Radio and our Facebook Live podcast with Talking at Music Education. And I'm here today with probably one of my most special people I've ever had the chance
to
know.
Nice to hear.
Really, I don't think I need to make that public declaration. Bill Ivey, who is living here in Nashville now and has a really wonderful career in public affairs, public policy. He was the director, head of the National Endowments for the Arts in the Clinton administration. Yes. He served as the head of the transition team for the Obama administration. He has founded the Herb Center here at Vanderbilt, very much involved in cultural entrepreneurship and cultural preservation, an author, and just a beloved thought leader. Thank you, Bill,
for
being with us.
Thank you for the complimentary introduction.
Yes,
to be with you.
Well, easy to do that. He's also here at Summer NAMM to help us with a roundtable event we have this afternoon to have a guilt-free zone about collecting guitars.
Yes.
We're going to have a conversation with anyone who comes into a gentle circle of support, realizing that it's okay to collect as many guitars as you want, right?
Yes.
That's right, which you are one of them, right?
Yeah, I do serial guitar collecting.
Right.
Although I usually have seven or eight at any given time.
Right. You only can play one at a time. Let's just face it. But that's not what we're going to finally admit a few things and have some fun. So we always start talking at music education with a little bit of music making origin stories.
Okay.
So we know that you have been involved in many aspects of arts and culture, but was music your first thing that you did in the artistic side?
Yes.
As a musician, and where did that training and experience come from?
Well, I had a very interesting, I basically learned in the gutter. I was given trumpet lessons in a elementary school band when I was 8 or 9 years old, and it didn't take. My family moved all the time, and it didn't have the continuity that you need for formal music training. But in 1957, 58, I was struck as with a bolt of lightning by the Kingston Trio and Tom Dooley and the early part of the folk music revival. So I said to my father, I have got to have a guitar. And he bought me an inexpensive one. I had no way to learn to play it. I could hold it, but I couldn't play it. And there was no one really to teach me. And our family moved to northern Michigan, and a newly acquired friend, Orrin Tikkanen, Finnish-American musician, who's still active up there, he taught me the basics of playing the guitar. So when I say I learned in the gutter, I learned by ear, playing the guitar at a time when the skill that was most essential was the ability to listen to a recording and figure out what was going on, figure out the chord changes, figure out any melody, and pretty much use your ear to organize your playing. And that actually, as I have matured, I consider it to be my only skill. I can sit in a room with friends, and someone can sing just about anything, and I can immediately figure out what key they're in, and immediately figure out the chord changes.
It's D or G or E, E major, and I can just figure those chords. I think there just was an era that I was trained as a musician, but I still did that. You pick up the needle back on the, and they had the LPs, and you really liked that track, and you just go back and forth and back and forth till that track was worn out more than any other track on the LP. But that's how you learn.
That's how you learn.
And never underestimate underestimate the fact that much of being a musician is the ear, is listening. Yes. And
my ear became good enough so that it became very difficult to learn to read because my ear was always ahead of my eye. Mm-hmm. And so I still read very laboriously, even though I've studied music theory and have worked at it. But guitar is not a great sight reading instrument.
Well, and they invented the tablature. Yeah. They invented the tablature that opened up the opportunity for, you know, it kind of gave permission. And then the folklore, the folk music, you know, movement, it was so interesting. You mentioned that. I know, you know, the dreadnought guitar, everything, just there's such a history around it. The entertainment, live music entertainment, acoustic guitar, you know, storytelling, dredging up what happened in small communities everywhere. Now we're getting into, you know, your other part of your professional life being a folklorist.
Yes.
Right? And I want you to give us a definition of a folklorist.
Well, a folklorist, and I tend to say folklore scholar simply because I don't think folklorist quite gets what it's about, but folklore scholar or folklorist is somebody who has spent a lot of time studying both the material of traditional culture, that is the songs, stories, jokes, practices, quilt making, all the elements of expressive life that aren't learned by from books, but are passed from generation to generation, often face-to-face in communities. And it's a kind of art making that tends to have very deep connections with heritage and tends to have a very deep connection with community. So the folklore scholar always says, well, this stuff is more important. It tells us more about people than, say, what novels they're reading, because this is homemade culture that's always, to a certain extent, shared. So I think folklore scholars over the years have become very adept at understanding the role of informal culture. And I was intrigued when Donald Trump first became president. One of the big comments about him was, well, he's not honoring customs. He's not honoring our traditions. He's not, and what those critics were saying was that he's not participating in the informal culture of being a government elected official leader and is sort of violating these norms. And it was a way of showing how important this informal culture really mm-hmm. can be. Because of the way I started in music, I developed a passion for traditional music that led to graduate study in the field of folklore. But I also had experience, you know, as an educator myself. As an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, I started frequenting a place called the Herb David Guitar Studio. It was kind of a famous place in Ann Arbor. And Herb had become desperate to find somebody to teach beginning guitar. And this was probably 1963, 64, and somewhat to my surprise, there were no methods. The guitar was so
the industry hadn't caught up.
Had not caught up, and so I had to make up my own method. I ordered a batch of Pete Seeger American Favorite Ballads, an Oak publication. I picked out the 6 or 8 songs that I thought every student would know. And I used those and a kind of tablature that I developed myself to teach kids how to play, to do what they wanted to do. They were coming and wanted to play.
The stuff they were hearing on the radio.
The stuff they were hearing on the radio, sing along, play with family and friends. And it kind of made me into what I would call a low culture snob. so that if you scroll forward to my years as chairman of the NEA. I mean, one of the big, you know, we were always fighting with what was then MENC. It's since changed its name, but you know, the NEA was always trying to provide artist residencies in schools. The MENC back then was fighting
for the qualified certified teacher,
because it had to be a qualified certified teacher. And if you look at school music even today, you see this very slow, very steady evolution in which what was once band music, chorus, maybe a classical ensemble if you had a bigger school that had the capacity to do that, into a much more broad-based,
much more diverse curriculum.
Yeah, and I think
now the guitar instruction and the technology, it's much more diverse. And I think our friends at the Music Education Association have really evolved with the times, that it's not an or proposition, it's an and proposition.
Yes.
That those artist residents really do well and better probably when they work with a teacher who is, you know, guiding a diverse curriculum. Mariachi's in the schools now.
Yeah, that's a,
bluegrass is in the schools.
Yeah.
The whole jazz choir and jazz vocal ensembles. And we just honored Manhattan Transfer last night at an event here. And I think the revolution that they led really as popular culture, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You've given me so many things to talk about, and I want to get to something that you just have a brand new book, your third book, Rebuilding an Enlightened World. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
But I wanted to, you know, give a little plug out there for this. And all the things that you are have contributed to our culture, high, medium, low, homemade. But this concept of homemade culture, this really, first of all, I love the term. And what we're hearing now in this, and you opened the door about our current administration, and we're going to not, you know, stomp on the threshold here, because this is not what this is about, talking about our current political circumstances. But to kind of touch base with that a little bit, when we look at the complexities of our federal government now, and the tensions there, and you were very much familiar with that, being a Washington person. As I say, we won't hold that against you.
Thank you.
Okay. That we hear in our media and our writing and journalism and analysis that it is in direct contrast to the vibrancy that's happening in community.
Yes.
That the energy that is happening in cities, around municipalities, homemade culture, homemade government, homemade, we're going to build our world. Can you talk a little bit about this?
There's a very interesting book by a couple, Jim Fallows and his wife, Deb. It's basically a brand new book. It's been out a month or 5 weeks, and it's called Our Towns.
I've heard about that.
And they basically, I know him because we're both airplane pilots, and he and Deb flew all around the country.
That's how they did their book tour.
That's how they did the book.
Well, that's how they wrote their book. Oh,
they went to visited towns and really to try to figure out mostly what's working. A few examples of things that are not working, but mostly what's working. And they discovered exactly what you observed, which is a real vibrancy in homemade art making and in community development that builds value for citizens through nurturing expressive lives.
And where they are.
Yeah. I talked to a folklore scholar, a friend of mine, who's a very prominent multi-book folklore guy up at Indiana University, Henry Glassie. And he said that in his experience, he did a long research project in Ireland at the time when the conflict there was really intense. His observation was that when the national government becomes unsettled and things are uncertain and feel disrupted, people pull into their communities and put more energy into what they can do in a homegrown way, right in town. And I think there's an element of that going on now. This has been happening for a long time, so it's unfair to anyone to say, well, this is some kind of a response to...
No, I think it's natural. It's in the germ, right?
But I think that there is a lot of energy at the community level, and a lot of it, the society, where there's something that we're facing, but not talking about, which is as technology kind of overwhelms society, we're going to be losing millions of jobs, and as technology replaces them. As we lose those jobs, citizens who have been told from birth that the way to achieve happiness is through work and wealth are going to have to find another path.
Well, this was a theme of your earlier
book. I've written about it in Arts, Inc. and in Handmaking America.
Handmaking was your second book.
Second book,
yeah, that was a powerful book, Handmaking in America.
Yeah, and just this idea that... we need an alternative way for people to have lives of meaning and purpose. And I think that a vibrant cultural life, because it connects you with cultural heritage. You know, if you study music, you are studying a great tradition. And it doesn't matter which form of music you pick, you are studying some great tradition. You're also connecting horizontally with community in ways that produce meaning. And I think that the arts in general and music in particular are going to become more and more important as society, as American society, is forced to say it's no longer reasonable. And I don't think it was ever the best way to build a life of meaning and purpose, but it's no longer going to be an option available to everybody to think about work and wealth mm-hmm. as the pathway to a successful, high-quality life. So I think there are some great opportunities on the frontier for arts leaders.
Cultural entrepreneurship.
Yeah,
right?
And people who can make the case. But one of my frustrations with my arts colleagues, not so much in music, but just in a general way, is that there's a desperate need for a justification for engagement with art, working with art, learning art, that is not just about, oh, if you study art, you'll get better SAT scores. You know, that
it's the instrumental benefits.
That's
right.
When we have to get beyond that. And I think that there will be that opportunity because there will be a casting about. You know, if work and wealth is no longer the path, well, what do we pursue?
Right.
What
does community connection, a vibrant neighborhood, you know, a vibrant place that's full of food. We know that how the food movement has changed communities and allowed a pathway for, again, not, you know, in very, very rare exceptions, you know, really significant wealth, but mostly just a really interesting job day to day.
Yeah.
And a community that cares about, you know, about that.
Sure.
I think.
And a person who can pick up a musical instrument, sing a song, and do things that build community value through talent and learning.
Yeah, it gives a really important and inspiring context for what our NAM members have been doing for decades in their communities. A small music retail store that serves, and now they're expanding to be live music venues and festivals and certainly music lessons and a community. And you know, it's interesting that they are, you know, and multi-generational in many ways, and they've become a fabric, part of that, a nucleus for that.
And I can ask you a question because this is something I don't know, but you might know, which is, Our community music stores experiencing something of the revitalization of the community bookstores?
I have to say, and this is, I would have to say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's represented here in the strength of the NAM shows. I mean, the NAM shows have weathered a pretty serious recession. I mean, we adjusted, but we continued with the belief, and I think you see the sustainability.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, they are sustaining with robust, they're sustaining strong businesses, they have employees, it might be 2, it might be 10, it might be hundreds, but they've consolidated businesses maybe from multiple shops across the state into one central place where they can really have their identity and have a hub of activity. So, you know, business is always challenging, but there is so much passion for it.
Yes.
And there, that passion, you talk about, again, a combination, the reason to do it is deeper.
And right? I think, you know, something that also is so important is that you don't make music without practicing. And there's a tendency these days for young people to be encouraged to think that, well, everything you might want to do is on a screen. Why learn to play an instrument? You can just touch something on your iPad or on your phone and you'll get a sound. You don't really need to learn to play. And I think that the value, the sense of achievement that comes with disciplined study over years, so you do the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours.
I think it's still about 10,000 hours.
Yeah, and I think that there's so much, again, to circle back to my point about finding a path to meaning and purpose. That's one of the ways to get there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's tough right now. This is why music education needs to make its point as loudly as possible, because there are a lot of pressures out there that's saying technology can substitute for everything. And if everything of meaning can be found on a screen. Mm-hmm. I know that's not true, but there are a lot of forces lined up that
we
want
know
us
that.
To believe that.
And I know you have to be assured that the NAM organization remains on that line mm-hmm. of advocacy for music education.
Yeah.
And again, we've seen, especially in our urban communities, a real reinstatement for, you know, when I think I first got to know you, there were no music educators in the city of New York. There are now 1,000 certified music teachers in the city of New York. When I moved to New York, there was the pink slip era.
Yes.
Every arts educator exited the New York City public schools. Now the new superintendent is a mariachi trumpet player. And he came from San Francisco and that's a pillar of his administration now as this new chancellor of education in the New York City Public Schools. So, you know, we're pounding on that drum relentlessly, but we must be vigilant. And
well, I agree. And I think, being optimistic, that in another downturn, I don't think the pink slips would automatically go to the arts Right. part of the education mm-hmm. system. I think that while we're not where we should be, the value of music education and arts learning in general is much more understood
right.
than it might have been a couple of decades ago.
And maybe we made inroads. I know we made inroads with those instrumental benefits. We got the attention about the value from saying, because reading scores, math scores, now we're doing research about a student's sense of efficacy in a school because that program is there, deeper to meaning and purpose.
Right.
We're growing. Yeah. But, you know, policymakers, they need to see black and white.
I know.
You know, I'm sorry.
But I think it's
meaning and purpose is like really cool, but show me the. So we've built a policy practice, advocacy practice, based on where they are and the decisions aren't being made. You know, we're talking at 12 o'clock with our coalition on coalitions gathering about the Title IV grant program, the Student Success and Enrichment Grant Program, that last year was at $400 million, is at now $1.1 billion. And is all about well-rounded and about school climate. And, you know, so we're making headway. And so let's end a little bit about talking about rebuilding an enlightened world, knowing that just off the presses by Bill Ivey, available Amazon, WordPress.
Yeah, in fact, there's a website, www.rebuildingenenlightenedworld.com.
Okay.
And that has a little bit about the book and also places to find it, including local independent
bookstores. My another person I admire so much in Arizona State, Stephen Tepper.
Yeah.
I admire him so much. He was at the Curb Center,
yes,
right?
Yes, he and I were colleagues, and we still talk regularly. But
again,
but
building a very creative higher ed
I know, he's doing great. He's got a supportive president at Arizona State. Yeah. Just doing great things. Rebuilding is really an attempt by me to kind of jump the fence a bit and do a book that's really about the current global situation. It has a lot to do about culture, not so much directly about the arts, although they show up in different places, but to really try to assess what's gone wrong and why the global situation and our overall environment here in the U.S. feels so unsettled. And the argument that I make is that the great enlightenment that goes back 200 years, you know, core values of social justice and democracy and individual rights and so on, that it's really threatened. It's really, people are pushing back against it and that we need to begin again and rebuild those values in a new way. So the book tries to get in. It's very, very interesting. I think the last year and a half has generated, gosh, a half dozen or 10 books about what's wrong. You know, has liberalism
we're here. Those are
globalization.
Those books are being published now.
Yeah.
The thinkers and writers had to think and write for a year or so, and now they're just reaching the shelves.
So this book is an attempt to get into that arena
and
see if my ideas can be there with maybe some more established, better known public intellectuals. But it's always, this relates to what we were just chatting about. In the U.S. situation, because we don't have a cultural ministry. We've never had kind of that nationalistic approach to culture that France and Germany, these other countries have. Because we haven't had a ministry or a Department of Cultural Affairs, the cultural world is not seen as a serious part of public policy. And so
we're always sort of wedging ourselves and we push in.
Yeah, we're trying. It's like, you know, well, so the arts guy writes a public policy book. Well, what does that mean? You know, can he be taken seriously? And it's an interesting challenge for me and maybe kind of a challenge to the system to see if my voice can get in. I mean, the book's been out for 5 days. So,
right, well,
so as our president, I said, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens with this book. We'll see what happens with this bigger problem of that we talk about. But I think what we can be assured of is that homemade culture is the wave, right?
I agree.
And music and our NAM members and our community of music educators and what they're doing, they should be reinforced that what they're doing is important.
Yeah. And I think we're living in the golden age of the guitar. This is a special emphasis for NAM at the moment. And I think the guitar is the gateway to homegrown, homemade artistry.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, the sky's the limit because the value of that kind of artistry is only going to increase.
Yeah. So maybe now you know why this is one of my favorite people to talk to. And
well,
we could go on and
we
on,
could go on and on,
and on,
yeah.
And on and have a series. And then some of it might only be available to private audiences because we would talk politics.
Well, we got into politics a little.
We could go much deeper. Yes. But Bill, thank you so much for joining us here at Summer NAM.
Yeah.
And good luck with the book. Bill Ivey, Rebuilding an Enlightened World, and the third book that he's authored, many articles, many speeches, many conference convenings. This is just among your many activities, and we look forward to seeing you at our Guitar Collector Anonymous group this afternoon.
Yes.
And to all of you, thank you for joining us. Be sure to share us so people can know that we've had this great discussion with Bill Ivey. Good luck wherever you go in your little airplane.
Thank you, Mary.
And all the fun that you have, and we hope to see you soon. And thank you for joining us for Talking at Music Education, a podcast of the NAM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. Nam. That's Mary L-N-A-M-M.